What does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus? I'm asking that out loud so you can participate. What does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus?
To reach out to others.
Okay. But there's an action to that, that we reach out to others. What else? What does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus? Gabby?
Sharing the good news with Jesus.
Sharing the good news. Okay.
Continually trying to learn about him and to be like him.
Continue to learn and try and be like Jesus.
Love your brother. That's probably the hardest one.
Wayne, I would add sister in there too. But yes, to love our sisters and our brothers.
Jesse said that's hard.
It is. And Paul's your brother. That's really hard. He's an older brother, but he's a brother.
Disciple has kind of the meaning of student. So a disciple would be looking at Jesus to learn from him and emulate that person. And so, yeah, kind of what John was saying, being a student of Jesus.
Even more of like an apprenticeship. Like nowadays, I'm like a student, I think. I get my Mac out and I take notes. I don't do a whole lot afterwards. But more apprenticeship, yeah. Like we're doing what we're being taught to do.
Right.
As a vocation.
So, as the Lord would have it, this idea of being a student and an apprentice, I didn't seed those answers. But we're going to talk about that today. And we're starting out with the passage from Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 1. Some of you already know what that is. It is the Beatitudes. It is God painting a picture of what it looks like to live the life of one of God's children. It's a lofty set of sample behaviors and ways of thinking and mindsets. But it is important for us. And so for the next several weeks, we're going to go through each one of the Beatitudes. And there's going to be a couple things we're going to do with each one. Number one, we're going to kind of define what that Beatitude means and really understand how do we live the life of one who's blessed by God. How do we live that? Second, we're going to try and put that into the context of other things we see taught, especially in the New Testament and in the Gospels. And third, the encouragement is going to be for us to take this home and use it as a practice. For us actually to be ready to practice what it means to live out these Beatitudes. Now here's the difficult part. Every week I will begin then with a question to reflect on the last week. So I want us to push our discipleship over these coming weeks. And I want us to be willing to practice something in our faith and then in turn be bold enough to come back the next week and share how that practice went. Now, I'm not going to sit and call each one of you because I realize some of us just aren't comfortable sharing things out loud in a group. My hope, though, is over the next several weeks that we'll become comfortable understanding that we're all doing the same thing. We are apprentices of Jesus. We're learning what it means to live like Jesus would have us live. And none of us are perfect at it. Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 1. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up to the mountainside and sat down, and his disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. And he said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. And blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, say false things against, and all kinds of evil against you, because of me. Rejoice and be glad. Great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. The first beatitude calls for us, or calls for those who are poor in spirit. They are blessed, the poor in spirit. And the reward for that is that they will inherit the kingdom of heaven. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. It actually is more than inherit. It is that it is presently the kingdom of heaven. Theirs is the kingdom now for those who are poor in spirit. So as I was reading through this passage and considering samples, Jesus had probably the greatest commentary on this himself. In Luke chapter 18, Jesus tells a parable that really gives us the clearest picture of what it means to be poor in spirit and why those people are blessed. Starting in verse 9 of 18, the parable goes this way. There were some who were confident in their own righteousness and looked down on everybody else. And so Jesus told a parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. And the Pharisee stood up and prayed and prayed about himself. God, I thank you that I am not like these other men. These robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all that I get. But the tax collector stood off in the distance. He wouldn't even look up to heaven. And he beat his breast and he said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. The Apostle Paul began his ministry as one who had exalted himself. He had laid on his shoulders the responsibility of purging the Jewish people of these followers of Jesus Christ, to the point of persecuting them unto their death. That's the first time we're introduced to Saul, is at the stoning of one of Jesus' disciples named Stephen. Stephen, as a follower of Jesus, was convinced that people needed to understand the gospel and the story of Jesus, the one who was the Christ, the Messiah, and the one through whom salvation would come. But instead, Saul was angry at these words, a self-righteous Pharisee. He himself said, I was a Pharisee of the Pharisees. All the Pharisees thought I was a better Pharisee than them, and I knew it. And he was there at the stoning of Stephen, and people trusted him with their garments. They gave them to him. He was the coat boy at that stoning. And he pridefully started moving forward until a moment on a road in which Jesus encountered Saul. And that encounter was so impactful that it physically knocked him from his horse. The moment and the encounter with the real God struck him blind, to the point that this prideful man was now holed up inside a house, waiting for someone to come and bring him healing. This one who was in complete control, who had everything about him that he could take charge of, and knew in his own mind that he was in charge, was now sitting quietly in a house waiting. And he had no clue what he was waiting for. Because the one that would ultimately come and heal him was one who was himself a follower of Jesus, the very ones that he sought to persecute. In order to consider how we can truly be poor in spirit, sometimes it's helpful to consider the opposite. The philosopher Aristotle, in his day, and in very much the same time frame as these New Testament passages were written, said in order to understand how to live life, we have to understand what the extremes were. If Paul was the extreme of not being poor in spirit, then what's the other end?
False humility.
False humility. What else? What's the other end? If this absolute pride and self-assurance is one end,
I'm not good enough to serve God.
I'm not good enough. Maybe it's not even false, Wayne. Maybe it is truly look in the mirror and say, there is nothing about me that is worth redeeming. And in the middle, there's a place that we realize that we are worth redeeming because God says we are. That we receive the words of the gospel saying, come to me, all of you who are weary and laden with the burden of sin. I will give you rest. That like this publican, this tax collector who was there in the temple that day, beating his chest saying, God, have mercy on me. He didn't see anything worthwhile, but he knew that God saw something in him and he was willing to cry out to God for redemption. Perhaps that's the middle ground where we are truly poor in spirit. Paul hit that middle ground after his encounter. The kingdom of heaven is not ours by birthright. We don't deserve heaven. But in fact, what it is we are each one of us born in the image of our Creator. You each one have been given a uniqueness that only God can give you. I call that the thumbprint of God in all of our lives. Each one of us is, in fact, special. William is special. He's forgotten it, but he's special. Carter's special, not just because she's our granddaughter, but because God already said that. Each one of us is already special. And yet, we come to this place where we are given the opportunity to be poor in spirit and receive the kingdom. Ours is the kingdom when we come with this poverty of spirit. The man in the temple that day praying, it was already his kingdom. He was already a part of that kingdom because he came in humility praying, Lord, have mercy on me. And God said, yours is the kingdom of heaven. But how do we get there? We have to learn. We have to learn what it means to be people with repentant hearts. We must become students of what it means to be poor in spirit. The Greek word here for poor in spirit, and I actually think poor in spirit isn't the best translation. I like the King James uses the word meek. I think that's actually a better translation. I think the NIV and the word poor in spirit, it kind of gives us an idea of almost a little bit of, you know, I don't have anything. But meekness is a little different word for us. To come humbly, recognizing our brokenness, recognizing our need to receive. And poor in spirit can mean that too. But the real group, the Greek word, root here, the word is praeus. And it means this. It means a mindfulness of our disposition. In other words, we understand where we are, that we are people who need, that we have a gentle spirit, not one of pride or of abrasiveness, and that we are meek. Without meekness, we cannot learn. Do you know why? Because if we, like Paul and like this one, the Pharisee that went in to pray and said, God, I've already done it all. They have no room to learn in their minds. They already are convinced they have the right answers. And so therefore, nothing can be taught. In working with county corrections early on, way early, one of the first things I learned, Erin Mader did our volunteer training, and she talked about stages of change. And this is something it'd be great to explore further, but stages of change. The first stage of change is that I don't need to change. It's the rest of the world that's screwed up. It's the legal system that put me here that needs to change. It's the judge who didn't care about my needs who needs to change. It's the prosecutor, the cop. It's my parents. It's my sister. It's the guy who got me caught with the drugs that needs to change. Not me. They are not poor in spirit, no matter how they look coming into the courtroom shackled, or how they look coming into Strengthening Families or into College of Trades. They're not poor in spirit. That moment of poor in spirit comes about three stages down, when all of a sudden people realize that I'm the problem. I need to learn something new. And that is the stage in which the corner turns and people begin to gain new knowledge, and they begin to gain new directions, and they begin to start new paths. It's later in those stages of change that we start recognizing in our humility, with meekness, that we need to change. But this is the same for us. It is not just those who are walking into our courtrooms or into our programs. It is Lee Jost that has to realize at some point that in order for me to be meek and teachable, I must surrender that I've got this all under control. But that can be taught if we are willing. Humility can be taught if we are willing. New ways of living can be taught if we are willing. It's the same thing for our sinful behaviors that we practice in Strengthening Families, and that we practice in the College of Trades, and that we practice in the work, the redemptive work we do in the community. One of the young men I work with at the Transitional Living Program is right now, he drives his girlfriend's car to and from work. The problem is he does not have a valid driver's license. And I told him over and over, you're setting yourself up for failure. And his posture was, I've got to do what I've got to do. That was his words. I got to do what I got to do. And I thought, he's not willing to learn yet. He doesn't have a humble spirit. Jesus begins the Beatitudes with the end in mind. If you will start reading through this list with a humble spirit, this list will transform you. If you start thinking you've got it all figured out, this list will become nothing but a clanging gong and a sounding cymbal. It will mean nothing to you. As we enter into this season of reading through these Beatitudes, Jesus calls us to understand the posture for these Beatitudes begins with a humble, meek spirit, a poor spirit, like the man in the temple beating his chest, saying, God, have mercy on me. Each thing that we do where we allow ourselves to be teachable allows these Beatitudes to wash over us. And as Paul later says, that it becomes the washing of the water of the Word. It pours over us, it nourishes, cleanses, and changes us forever. This week I'm calling for us to practice this Beatitude quite simply by recognizing in our own lives the moments that we come to, where if we're willing to listen to our own hearts and if we're willing to be intellectually honest with ourselves, we realize, I'm struggling with being teachable here. Maybe I think I've got it all figured out here. Maybe I think I can do my own thing here. The challenge for all of us is this. Each one of us desperately wants to be self-sufficient. We want to be the ones who come to everyone else and say, I have enough to share with you. But when the tables are turned and we are supposed to be weak and receive ourselves, we don't like it. We don't want to be the one who needs to receive and to learn. Because suddenly we look at ourselves in the mirror and we say, we're too weak. We're too poor in spirit. And my statement to you is, you are not. To receive help and encouragement from someone else means you are exactly where Jesus wants you to be.